Welcome to this very interesting event this evening. Couldn't be more topical, given what we're hearing at the moment about a carbon tax. And of course, the wider issue, climate change, is something that occupies all of our minds in one way or another. It's certainly a lively debate with various splits across the population. I mean, as you know, there are some people who are called alarmists and some people who are called denialists, and they seem to agree about nothing when it comes to climate change, which is fair enough. But I think there are also quite a number of people in the middle, perhaps a growing number if you look at the opinion polls, who are really unsure about what all this means. I mean, the science of climate change is so broad, so huge, so overwhelming that it's very difficult for anybody who doesn't have some kind of aspect of science to understand what it's all about or to form cogent opinions. I certainly fall in that category, but I do think that we have an issue here, and it's very important to discuss it in forums like this so that people can make an informed decision about what this all means for us. Even scientists themselves, of course, are divided and argumentative, as we've seen. It's very difficult to make sense of it all, except to say that clearly we need to protect our planet. Whether you engage in the climate change debate or not, we clearly need to look after this planet because it's all we have. And the question is, when it comes to climate change, how do we best approach this in terms of protecting the planet? I think my own view is that, and I know a number of other people would share this, is that we need to approach it calmly, rationally, and unemotionally. There's far too much emotion in this debate, and it requires very rational thinking, lateral thinking, if you like. And I think we're going to hear a little bit about that this evening. I would like to end this brief introduction by quoting the end of Bjorn Lomborg's book, Cool It, which I found illuminating on this whole topic. He said, "We want to look back from here and say we didn't just do something to make us feel good. We did something that actually did good." Now, at 7:30, we're going to be entertained with more wine and food until 8 o'clock. But now I would like to hand over to my colleague, Lawrence Wade, who is responsible for this evening's event, who will do the introductions and guide us through the evening. Lawrence, thank you.
Thank you, Graham. And thanks to all of you for coming this evening to yet another Australian Institute of International Affairs. Very topical, and I think going to be a very illuminating address this evening. And we're honored to have this evening visiting us from overseas, from Canada and Denmark respectively, two fascinating speakers on this crucial topic of climate change, a way forward. And I'm pleased to have addressed us this evening Associate Professor Bjorn Lomborg and the Canadian architect Michael Green. The format for this evening is that I'll ask Bjorn to speak to us for 20 minutes or so, Michael for 15, and then we'll have a good Q&A session after that. And as Graham said, at 7:30, Bjorn and Michael have to leave for the airport, but we'll continue with drinks and canapes because in the time available to us, you couldn't get through all the drinks and food that we have made available for this evening, so we're delighted to have you stay on afterwards. But we have to finish at 7:30 for our guests to leave it for getting onto an aeroplane. So could I ask Bjorn to come and address us on the topic of climate change, a way forward? Thank you.
Thank you very much, and as you also heard, we have very little time, so I will be very brief. Thank you very much, Lawrence, and I'll look forward to talk to you about how we should think and tackle global warming. Given that this is one of the big issues of the time, it does seem sensible that we can do this in 20 minutes. I would like, before we just get going, to just remember, what is it we're actually trying to achieve? Because we have a tendency in this climate debate to just jump right ahead and say that it's all about cutting carbon emissions. But let's just remember, presumably, this is about making a better world. And we've got to ask ourselves, how do we do that? I think a large part of what we do in the climate debate is mostly about feeling good rather than actually doing good, as you also just alluded to in the end of my book. It's about something that's fashionable rather than something that actually does good, something that's rational. So I'd like to pull us back and say, what can actually work? At the same time, I think we would be well served by getting rid of some of the emotionalism that was also alluded to earlier and get a sense of what is actually up and down in this climate debate. We need to remove our myths simply because being panicked is not likely to be a good state to be in to make important decisions. And then, of course, at the last part of my point is simply going to be say, we only got a limited amount of money. If we overspend on some things, it means we end up underspending on other issues. So let's make sure we find the smartest and most effective strategies to fix climate change and all the other issues in the world. So I would really just like to make four simple points here tonight, simply because we only have that much time, but also I think really if we're going to engage the public in talking about this incredibly crucial issue, I think we're absolutely right. We cannot expect people to be reading hundreds and hundreds of pages of literature, and certainly not the UN Climate Panel, which publishes what, 300-800-page reports every 5 or 6 years that are just, again, only summaries of the tens of thousands of peer-published articles. We need to find a smarter and simpler way. So I would like to just simply engage you in thinking, how do we tackle this problem with just four simple points? I put up a picture here of Al Gore and me. We gave a presentation to Congress a couple of years ago to say, there's many, many different views, but I really think we need to reel back and realize all of us want to fix climate change. All of us want to do good. We have different opinions about what's going to get us there, but I think we need to stop calling each other names and start thinking about, are there smart middle-of-the-road arguments to be achieved? As was pointed out, yes, we have deniers, yes, we have alarmists, and I would like to present to you what I think is a smart middle-of-the-road argument, in some sense, a solutionist argument. Instead of just screaming up at the problem, let's start talking about what actually works. So, the four points. The first one is, global warming's real, it's man-made, it is an important problem, it is something we need to fix. So let's get the whole denialist argument to rest. I think there's very little argument left over to say that nothing is happening, and certainly people have no responsibility to this. I would actually argue that this is on the agenda, thanks to Al Gore and many others, having put it into the American mind and certainly around the world, that this is a problem we need to fix. I would argue again that the best information we have comes from the UN Climate Panel, the so-called IPCC. This certainly doesn't mean it's perfect, as we've also seen a year and a half ago. There's definitely problems, but it's the best that we have, and I think we need to revert to saying if we're going to make good judgment, we need to ask essentially what's the best information we have. That comes from the UN Climate Panel. Let me just give you a sense of what they're saying. Again, you know, lots and lots of information out there, but just get a sense of what are they expecting? Well, if you look at the likely temperature rise over this century, they're saying it's going to be around 2.6 degrees centigrade rise by the end of the century compared to today. Their scenarios show somewhere between 1.6 and 3.8 degrees centigrade. That doesn't sound like very much, but because it's an average, it's actually a significant change of the world. The economic models, and that's part of what I'm going to be talking a lot about, indicates if you try to add up all the benefits and disbenefits of global warming, remember, global warming is not just going to be bad, but it's going to be predominantly bad. So if you add up all the impacts of global warming into the indefinite future and discount it back till today, essentially say how much money would you have to pony up today to cover all the damages into the extended future for global warming, the answer is the cost is about $15 trillion. That used to be a very big number before the financial crisis, but in some ways, it still is, right? It certainly is a number that's big enough that it ought to make us sit up straight in our chairs and start thinking about how do we deal with this in the best possible way. On the other hand, and that's important to recognize, the net worth, and this is again all the estimates from the UN Climate Panel, the net worth of the 21st century is about $3,000 trillion. So remember, we're talking about half a percentage point of the 21st century. That's the amount, approximately, that global warming is going to do damage. It's important because it indicates very clearly it's not zero, as many denialists would say, but it's not 100% or something like that, as we often seem to hear from the media. It's half a percentage point. And that indicates that we need to fix global warming. It is a problem. We need to find a smart solution. But first of all, of course, we need to find a solution that doesn't actually cost more than the original ailment, and we also need to implement it smartly. And so that's really what this conversation is about. It's not about the alarmist. It's not about having this big row. It's about finding solutions. And that's really what this is about, finding a solution to a 0.5% problem of the 21st century. That's certainly a significant issue. It's one of the many we need to fix in the 21st century. So what should we do? Well, before I get there, I'd like to just talk to you a little bit about the problems that we very often have in this conversation. As was mentioned earlier, it's a very emotional issue. And I would argue, to a very large extent, it's because what we hear about global warming is often very exaggerated and or one-sidedly presented. And that leads to bad judgment. Again, if you have a gun to your head, you're unlikely to make smart, you know, overall and cool assessments. So we need to take away the hysteria and start talking about how should we tackle global warming. So yes, global warming is real, it's man-made, it is an important problem, but it's often vastly exaggerated and one-sided. And let me show you how that plays out. I'm going to look at the standard story. I think nobody has told that better than Al Gore. Al Gore said, but of course many, many others are saying this up to this day, Al Gore called global warming a planetary emergency and told us, we have just 10 years to avert a major catastrophe that could send our entire planet into a tailspin of epic destruction involving extreme weather, floods, drought, epidemics, and killer heat waves beyond anything we've ever experienced. That certainly sounds like something you want to avoid, right? Let's take a look at some of those statements, because those are the kinds of statements that we hear all the time, and of course, especially here in Australia, where we're being told that many of these things are going to devastate our future. I'm just going to take a look, in the interest of time, at two issues. Let's take a look at killer heat waves. Let's take a look at heat deaths. Also, let's take a look at the extreme weather that we're often told that we're going to see. Let's take a look at hurricanes. These are by no means the only things, and I'd love to take more of these issues up in the question time. I've done so in my book as well. But fundamentally, it gives you a good sense of how we're being told part, but only part of the truth. And I think that would be helpful if we understand the broader context of what we're being told. Let's take a look at heat death. Are we going to see more heat deaths with global warming? Absolutely. I mean, it's not very complicated. If temperatures go up, we're going to see more heat waves, and hence we're going to see more people die from heat. It's as simple as that. We have some of the best studies from Europe. About 50 researchers across Europe studied all the impacts of heat and cold deaths in Europe, and they actually estimated, just to give you one example, that for the UK from the middle of the century, global warming every year is going to mean about 2,000 more people dying from global warming. That's certainly an important number, and that's certainly a number that we ought to be honest about. I think, on the other hand, it's also very true that a lot of people are telling us, oh my God, 2,000 more people are dying, we've got to do something. But we need to tell the whole story. It's not enough to just tell part of that story, because obviously as temperatures rise, we're going to see more heat waves, and hence more people dying from heat. But likewise, as temperatures rise, we're going to see fewer cold waves, and hence fewer people dying from cold. We need to tell that story too. Now, of course, if that was a marginal number, maybe it wouldn't matter, but it's not. The very same numbers that indicate that 2,000 more people are going to die in Britain by mid-century because of global warming also estimate that in Britain by mid-century because of global warming, we're likely to see fewer cold deaths. And not just a trivial number, but about 20,000 fewer cold deaths. And so my argument is simply to say we're ill-served if we're being told, oh my God, 2,000 more people are going to be dying, which is true, but failed to be told that 20,000 fewer are going to die as well. Now, of course, you might excuse me for saying, you know, I'm from Denmark, maybe we'd like a little more heat, but actually, this is true for virtually all regions. If you look at the only peer-reviewed published study that indicates the number of deaths from heat and cold across the entire world, they indicate that we're likely to see about 400,000 more dead and 1.8 million fewer cold dead from global warming by mid-century, and that actually holds all the way to 2200. So it's a very different story from what we're being told. But that's not my main point. My main point is really notice how very often we're being told that because of global warming, we should because of heat deaths, we should cut carbon emissions because that's the way to help future victims of heat death. Well, let's just think about that for a second. You might remember the biggest heat wave we've seen in current time is the August 2003 European heat wave that killed about 35,000 people across the continent, just 7,500 in Paris, France alone. A lot of people say to honor those memory, all those old ladies, mainly old lady that died in Paris, France, to honor their memory, we should cut our carbon emissions so that future generations of old ladies in Paris, France don't die. Now, that sounds really nice, but let's just think about it. If we start cutting our carbon emissions, temperatures will still rise, they'll only not rise quite as much. So essentially, we're saying, yeah, more and more old ladies in Paris, France are going to die, but slightly fewer more towards the end of the century. That's going to be our political goal. Honestly, can't we do it better than that? And the answer, short answer, is yes, we can. There are much better ways to help people that are actually going to have heat deaths. I mean, one obvious point is virtually nobody dies from heat deaths in the U.S. Why? Because they have air conditioning. If we care about old women in Paris, France, who are going to die, give them air conditioning. It's really not more complicated than that. Of course, a lot of people would then feel uncomfortable because that actually means that we're going to emit more CO2. But another way, and possibly cheaper and certainly more effective in the long run, would probably be to recognize that the vast number of people in humanity is going to be living in cities by the end of the century, probably about 90% are going to be living in cities. Cities are much warmer than their surrounding countrysides, basically because they have lots of asphalt, lots of black surfaces, and very little water and greenery that cools the city. So why don't we do something about that? Simple ways to do that. If the problem is that there's little water, why don't we put in more water features, more greenery? We actually know this for London, New York, Los Angeles, many other cities. Let me just show you the numbers for London. If we added more water and greenery, we would be able to reduce heat wave temperatures in London about 8 degrees Celsius. Much more than global warming will ever increase the temperature. We could decrease it, and we could make London a much more beautiful city, and we could do it much, much cheaper. And of course, if the real problem is all that asphalt, all those black surfaces, why don't we paint the asphalt in light colors, or maybe paint the rooftops? If we painted a quarter of the rooftops in London, we could reduce heat wave temperatures about 10 degrees Celsius. Again, the point here is simply to point out, yes, global warming is a problem. Yes, more people are going to die from heat waves. We should also know that many fewer people are going to die from cold waves. But we do care about the people who are going to die from heat waves. Why don't we help them effectively rather than incredibly ineffectively? Why don't we help them cheaply rather than incredibly expensively? That is the fundamental point. So Al Gore and many others are correct in pointing out more people are going to die from heat, but they fail to tell us many more people are not going to die from cold, and the preferred action, namely cut carbon emissions, is actually the least effective way of helping future victims of heat deaths. So let's start doing the smart things. And the same thing goes for extreme weather. If we look at hurricanes, some of the best studied hurricanes, we have pretty much the same numbers for Australia, but I'm going to show you the ones for the US because they go much further back. This is from 1900 until 2009. So the last 109 years, damage impact in the US from hurricanes, inflation adjusted, so you can't actually compare the numbers. What you're essentially seeing is that there was no impact in the early part of last century, very little impact in the middle of last century, and only towards the end of last century and beginning of this century, they dramatically increased. This seems to indicate that Al Gore and his ilk is very correct. Global warming is going to make the damage cost in the US go up and up, and it's just going to get worse and worse. It is very true that costs are going to get worse and worse. It has very little to do with global warming. It has everything to do with the fact that many more people live with much more stuff closer to where hurricanes hit. Let me show you one. This is Miami Beach in 1926. Is it clear that if a hurricane hits here, yes, you've probably got to move some deck chairs, but it's probably not going to cause that much damage. Whereas, of course, if the same hurricane, if a hurricane hit the same place in 2006, there would be a lot more damage. So the researchers that looked at the first graph I just showed you said, what would have happened if all US hurricanes that hit the US over the last 109 years had hit the US in those years, but as if the US was as it is today? So all hurricanes hit the US as it is today. That's essentially adjusting for the change in wealth and population. And what it shows us, this very, very dramatically different picture. You see much, much more damage in the first part of last century. Actually, the most damaging hurricane was the 1926 Miami hurricane, great American Miami hurricane that tore right through downtown Miami. But as you just saw, not much there to damage. Although, had it hit today, it would have been the costliest damage in the U.S. history. It was also one of the deadliest that killed about twice as many as died in Hurricane Katrina. The second largest was the Galveston hurricane in 1900, the biggest killer in the U.S., about five times as many as Hurricane Katrina. And Hurricane Katrina was only the third largest. It was 80 billion of the 150 that we saw in 2005. We see a very, very different picture, and that's important. Because what really matters is, again, how we leave the world for our descendants. Do we want to leave a world where we feel better about ourselves, or one where we've actually made a difference? And again, that's incredibly important to ask ourselves. What can we actually do? Well, if we look at reasonable worst-case scenarios, we're actually expecting with global warming that hurricanes will get a little worse, but they'll probably get a little fewer. So if we take a look at the reasonable worst-case scenarios, we'll probably see by mid-century about a 10% increase in damage costs from climate change. But by mid-century, we'll probably see a 500% increase because of changes in social variables, mainly more people with more stuff closer to harm's way. Why is it we talk so much about cutting this little bit, a tiny bit? If everybody did the Kyoto Protocol, we could probably cut about half a percentage point here. But if we focused on this bit, the big one, we could probably, by changing social variables, cut the damage impact somewhere between 250 and 400 percentage points. We could possibly even make it negative, leaving future generations better off. How? Well, we don't even have that conversation right now because everybody is focused on cutting carbon emissions. But if we actually want to help people not being killed or injured or having damages from climate change, there are much simpler ways that we could go about doing that. One of the strongest ones would be to stop subsidizing insurance, as done, for instance, in Florida, which essentially encourages people to build irresponsibly. We should have better building codes, better enforcement of building codes, zoning. There's lots of different ways that we can achieve dramatic cuts in damage impacts. So again, my point here is really to say, yes, when Al Gore and many others are telling us there's going to be more heat deaths, they're right. But they're forgetting to tell us that there are going to be fewer cold deaths, and they're forgetting to tell us that their preferred solution, cut carbon emissions, is an incredibly inefficient way to help future generations, and that goes for hurricanes as well. That does not mean we shouldn't also tackle global warming, but it does mean when we talk about all those people we care about in the future, they're much cheaper, much easier, and much more efficient ways to help them. We still need to fix global warming, and that's the third point I'd like to talk about. How should we actually go about this? So, yes, global warming is real. We're often being misled in the sense that we are being exaggerated or one-sidedly told stories that make us focus on inefficient solutions rather than efficient solutions. But let's look at how we should actually go about fixing global warming. Well, the problem is the current approach is broken, and it's been broken for the last 20 years. We actually went to Rio in 1992 and promised to cut carbon emissions. We did no such thing. We overshot ourselves by about 12%. Then we went to Kyoto and promised even more and did no such thing, overshot that by 25%. Then we went to Copenhagen and actually expected to do more. And of course, it failed totally. And yet everyone went to Mexico last year and said, hey, let's try again. And they're going to go to South Africa this year and try again, and then to Rio as the 20th anniversary. At some point, you got to stop repeating your mistakes over and over again. Why is this happening? Because the current approach is essentially saying, let's cut a lot of carbon right now, which is fairly expensive and does fairly little good even a long time into the future. Take Kyoto. If everyone had done Kyoto, the cost, this is the average of all the macroeconomic models, would have been about $180 billion a year. Yet the net reduction in temperature by the end of the century would have been immeasurable. Of course, we didn't do that at all, so it's even more immeasurable. But the central point remains, why are we spending that much money on doing that little good? Yet that's what we keep doing. The only promise for 2020 on the books is the EU promise of the 2020 decision that we're going to cut 20% below 1990 levels by 2020. The cost, again, across all the macroeconomic models, is indicated to be about $250 billion a year. Yet, when the EU has spent $250 billion every year for the rest of the century, $20 trillion, the net effect will be to have reduced temperatures by 1/20th of 1 degree centigrade. We won't be able to measure the impact of having spent $20 trillion by the end of the century. I would argue that's a pretty poor policy. And the economists actually concur. If you do the analysis, it turns out that for every dollar the EU spends, we avoid globally about 3 cents of climate damage. That's a poor way to spend a dollar. You didn't do no good, but you certainly didn't do very much good. We could do much more good, but let me just one more point, talk about the 2 degrees centigrade, which everyone, including Australia, signed up to, the idea that temperatures shouldn't rise above 2 degrees above pre-industrial level. The cost of that is going to be a phenomenal $40,000 billion by the end of the century. And this, by the way, is if everyone does the smartest thing possible. This is 13% of global GDP. Of course, that's not going to happen. But even if we did, every dollar spent would only do about 2 cents of climate good. That's a bad way to put it. And of course, remember, again, if we relax the assumption that they're going to do it smartly, politicians are all going to do this coordinatedly and smartly with all the efficient instruments across the century, across all continents, the cost could easily dramatically increase. So the fundamental problem here is the current set of approaches simply does not work because it's saying, let's do very expensive things that'll do very little good 100 years from now. That's why they're failing. And to the extent that we're doing, we're simply wasting our money. And so I would like to take you into an idea of saying, is there a smarter way? And yes, there is. Before I do that, I'd like to just give you one metaphor, which I think in many ways resonate with how we think about global warming. It's the polar bears. If you see a picture of a polar bear, you think about global warming. They look really cute. They are really cute, unless you're close to them. But the point, of course, here is to recognize, are polar bears endangered? Well, in a sense, yes. Polar bears will have a harder time with diminishing and eventually disappearing summer Arctic ice. So there is a problem. But I think there's two things most people don't recognize about polar bears. One is that they're certainly not in peril right now. Polar bear populations globally have actually increased probably quadrupled over the last 50 years. So polar bears are by no means in danger right now, but there is a problem in the future, one that we need to fix. And we need to ask ourselves, how are we going to go about doing that? But the only solution that you're being offered to tackle global warming, to help polar bears, is to cut carbon emissions. Let's just go down that line and say, well, how much will that actually help? If everyone implemented the Kyoto Protocol, which is 20 times more than what the world has managed to do, if everybody did that, how many polar bears would we save? Turns out, you'd save about one polar bear each year. Now, I like polar bears. I'm happy to save a polar bear, maybe even at a cost of a couple hundred billion dollars. But it strikes me as odd that we don't have a conversation about the fact that every year we shoot polar bears. And not just a few. Every year, the world shoots somewhere between 300 and 500 polar bears. I don't know about you, but if we want to help polar bears, maybe we should stop shooting 300 polar bears first. Not only would it be a couple hundred billion dollars cheaper, but it would also be better for 299 polar bears, right? And that's the real point of this conversation. If you care about these individual issues, make sure you actually care about them and care about them smartly. This does not mean we shouldn't also fix global warming, but we should have the same attitude and start talking about what would actually work. And let me just get to that and then I'll shut up. Fundamentally, I helped ask some of the world's top climate economists, including three Nobel laureates, what are the smartest ways and the stupidest ways to deal with climate change? They basically told us the current approach is incredibly stupid. That's the numbers that you saw, the 2 or 3 cents back in the dollar for the Kyoto-style approaches. Don't do those. What they told us, on the other hand, was the smartest long-term way to fix global warming is to dramatically increase research and development into green energy research. Fundamentally, they said spend 0.2% of GDP into research and development into non-carbon emitting energy technologies. The amazing thing here is that would be half the cost. It would be globally about $100 billion, about $1.6 billion for Australia. It would be half the cost of Kyoto and 50 times more than what the world is spending today. The simple trick here is to recognize, why aren't we changing to a green economy? Because it's expensive. if we could make green energy much cheaper, preferably cheaper than fossil fuels, we would have solved the problem. Everyone would switch, including the Chinese and the Indians, not because they were green, not because we forced them to through an elaborate arrangement like the Kyoto Protocol, but simply because innovations had made them cheaper. So the whole point here is to recognize solution has to be make green energy cheaper rather than try to make fossil fuel so expensive nobody wants it. That's the trick. And the amazing thing is, I'm talking about solar panels, but we should look at a broad range of different solutions. And there are lots of smart people out there working on these solutions. Now, they're not any of them cost effective right now, which is why it's still very costly to change. But once one or a few of them become cost effective, everyone will switch. That's why this also turns out investing dramatically in research and development will make global warming solved in the medium term. And the beautiful thing is, for every dollar spent on research and development, you'll do about $11 of climate good. You'll avoid $11 of climate damage. That's 500 times more good than the current approach that only avoids 2 or 3 cents of climate damage. So the simple point here is, and then I will stop, is yes, global warming is real, it's man-made, it's important that we fix it. If it often vastly exaggerated, and so we forget that there are smarter ways to deal with most of the problems that are being assessed when we're being told, that person died from heat waves, we should do something about global warming. No, give him or her air conditioning or make cities cooler. But it doesn't mean we shouldn't fix global warming, but we need to fix it smartly. The current approach is not doing so, and for very simple reasons that we've known for the last 20 years. Let's move on and do something that's both cheaper, much more effective. The beautiful thing is we do know that strategy. We've discovered it with the help of many of the world's top climate economists and Nobel laureates. The fundamental point is to say, instead of trying to make fossil fuel so expensive, nobody wants it, which will never work politically and is economically a very poor strategy, make green energy so cheap everyone wants it. If we innovate the price down to the point where it's cheaper than fossil fuels, we will have won. Turns out that's about 500 times more effective than the current approach, so we can spend less money, which everyone loves, and fix much more of the problem. So there you have it. Thank you very much.
Bjorn, thank you. That was cogent and clever and also good-humoured, which is perhaps a characteristic sometimes lacking in this and other debates. So thank you very much for your perspective on that. Bjorn, I didn't fully introduce you earlier, because we are limited on time tonight, and because your biography runs to several dozen pages. But I would like to spend a little bit more time introducing our next speaker, Michael Green, because he is a very interesting, up-and-coming, very talented Canadian architect who runs as a principal of MGB Architecture in Vancouver in Canada. Has got an overlapping, but I suspect a distinctive viewpoint on this issue of a climate change way forward. And I'd like to invite Michael Green to address this for the next 15 minutes or so on the topic. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. It's good to be here from Western Canada. I'm going to do this fairly quickly. And what I think, how this sort of meshes with the talk that Bjorn just gave, is I'm going to start talking about some of the solutions that really represent those mid-range solutions. We're not going to see the things I'm going to talk about next in the short term, but we're going to see, I hope, in a way, we're going to see these kinds of things happening in the medium term to kind of address the issues of climate, and this is not working. And why is this not working? Is that off? There we go. So really what I'm going to talk about is, as an architect, what are the challenges facing my sector of this overall conversation? Buildings represent, the built environment represents roughly a third of the issues around climate change. We know it's a huge a component of that is energy consumption. I'll brush on that. A huge component of that is the kinds of things we actually choose to build from and other aspects of impact on the environment. But what I'm going to talk about is the two big challenges that face the building sector, the architects and engineers worldwide, are really, in my mind, these two issues, climate change and the relationship that climate change ultimately has to world housing and ultimately the issue of population growth. Because what I'm going to show you as I walk through this is that as we work to solve world housing, one of those human needs, there's a direct relationship that actually could negatively impact climate. And in doing one good, we might ultimately do something quite bad as part of the process. So let's just go through quickly the issue of world housing. Basically, the statistic from the UN Habitat is that 3 billion people in the world will need a new affordable home in the next 20 years. That's a staggering number of people. That's obviously both in the developed world and the developing world, and the bulk of that is in the developing world. What that represents is 40% of the world's population will need a new home. So the quantity of building that we're looking at to meet the basic human need of shelter is effectively the equivalent of 100,000 new homes that need to be built every single day for the next 20 years. It's a staggering quantity of building that really no nation, no individual, no sort of corporation is thinking about how we actually solve that incredible human need and whether we even have the capacity to do so. But what we need to also recognize is the place that, and Bjorn touched upon this as well, the place that that's going to be solved is in urban environments. So today, half the world live in cities. In the next 30, 40 years, we're going to see that go to 70%. And I think Bjorn mentioned that it might be as much as 90% by the end of the century. So what that means is the types of conversations that we need to have around climate change with respect to building, the built environment, has to be thinking about what the future of cities look like. And not just thinking about it in terms of sort of how much density we put into cities, but actually what we make our cities out of, which is what I'm going to talk about next. So when we think about climate, these are the statistics, the range of statistics that buildings and the built environment represent as an impact on the environment. And these, I'd sort of illustrate these as ranges because obviously it's very difficult and there are different perspectives in different parts of the world. There are different issues as far as the level of impact, but it's fairly well established that roughly a third of greenhouse gas emissions come somehow from the building sector. So it's obviously we have a huge impact. The types of solutions that we talk about, and Bjorn mentioned this issue of needing to invest in green energy solutions, but and that's an incredibly fundamental part of what will be happening and the economic opportunities of what will be happening, hopefully. But the interesting thing, if you take that one-third that the built environment represents as far as greenhouse gas emissions, probably as much as 90% of energy use in buildings can go away just by the way we choose to design our buildings. So that huge energy demand we put out there doesn't actually require tomorrow that we think about it in terms of what that next energy solution is. It really comes down to some really practical and frankly kind of boring conversations about how much insulation are in our homes. They're really practical, low-tech, non-innovative, not very glamorous conversations that really will make a huge dent in this entire conversation, and yet we're barely scratching the surface of how that conversation really gets out there to the public. But what I'm really going to talk about in this talk is the fact that urban buildings, when I said 70% of the world are going to live in cities, that urban buildings have been built out of the exact same materials for the last 100, 125 years since the Industrial Revolution. And those materials are concrete and steel. And we don't think at all about the impacts of those two materials on the built environment because as architects and engineers, we just start every day thinking, okay, I'm building a big building, I'm going to build it out of concrete because that's what I always build my buildings out of. Concrete, besides water, is the second largest material by volume that we make on Earth as man. And what's really staggering about it is when you stack up the footprint, the carbon footprint of concrete, and we never talk about this in general conversation, we always often talk about the carbon footprint of flying in airplanes. It represents about 1% of world carbon. Shipping itself represents about 3%, but concrete, even the concrete industry itself, acknowledges represents 5% to 8%, depending on who you talk to and year to year. It's a staggering fact that concrete is a huge carbon footprint, but we don't question it. We just use it. And it's a wonderful material and has a great purpose and always will have a great purpose. But the real question is, what are we going to do with that fact? Is that something that we can actually change? And I think it is. So steel is something that is hugely energy intensive. It comes from a recycled, we can recycle it, so it's got some positive message. But the truth is it represents about 4.1% of world energy goes into the production of steel and iron. So these are huge footprint issues that we really don't question in society, and I think we're about to. So really the question becomes what exists, and if you paid any attention to the poster here behind me, you might get a hint already what exists, but What I'm really here to talk about is the fact that if we're looking for a material in the built environment, a simple material that both reduces our carbon emissions by taking away the amount of steel and concrete we use, but also finds a way to store carbon, we already have that material, and that's wood. And we never really think about it. And we haven't really explored its potential for 100 years because we just kind of assumed that steel and concrete were the best materials to build buildings out of. And so what's interesting is that time is changing. The building industry worldwide moves incredibly slowly. We're not going to see these change short term, like Bjorn mentioned. This is a long-term or mid-term solution. But I believe it will change because wood, a material that's grown by the energy of the sun, effectively sequesters, holds on for its life in a building or in a piece of furniture, wherever it is, 1.6 tons of carbon per cubic meter of wood. That's the staggering thing. So whereas it's the only material that ultimately offers that in the built environment. So in Canada, we talk about the fact that a typical Canadian home, which is made out of wood sticks, wood studs, sequesters 28 tons of carbon, which is equivalent to driving a family car for 7 years. It's a huge amount, and we don't really think about it. Of course, it also means that when we talk about this, and this is obviously important to me because I come from a timber economy, but it's important to everybody because the truth is that most buildings, especially those buildings in the developing world that are going to serve the majority of those 3 billion people, will be built in concrete. Those are really the only choices that most developing nations have. But wood must come from a sustainable managed forest environment. And the reason for that is deforestation has also been a huge contributor to the impact of global warming. We know that roughly 20%, depending on who you talk to, is the statistic of its impact over the last 100 years. And most of that, of course, is in developing nations. So really the question became, how do we move forward? How do we start thinking about a future of different types of buildings? It's not just sort of how they look and how they perform, but from an energy point of view, but how do we actually ask the question of what cities become if they're not built in steel and concrete? And the reality is, and I go back to this image of the Eiffel Tower, when Gustav Eiffel was asked to design for the World Expo the tower, he wasn't really actually allowed to build a building of this height. It was something that nobody could conceive of. He knew how to do it, he did it, and in doing so, he sort of launched us on the path to all the city skylines around the world where there was this race to see how tall buildings could become in steel or concrete. So the skyline of New York was defined by a race between developers to see who could go higher faster, and in doing so, that changed and transformed every city worldwide. And it's so, you know, common for us that we never even think about how our skylines have developed or if they will ever change. And perhaps they'll never change by their mass, by the size of the buildings, but the very essence of how they're built, I believe, will change. And it's not just for those reasons of how we store carbon in our structure, but also for some really important economic reasons. So the reality is worldwide, there's a chase. This is the beginning. We're on the sort of dawn of the XPRIZE kind of approach to what's going to happen. There's a stimulus for architects and engineers that are at the forefront of the conversation to say, how big a building can I make in wood? How big a building can I make in other natural fibers? Building systems and structures that don't exist today. And this is, again, why it'll take decades for this to actually be implemented on a wide scale, but it's the beginning of something. And across the world, we're starting to see changes in the maximum height of what we're allowed to build and changes in the kinds of opportunities that are created for us to dream. So, there are new materials, and that's really the essence of it. And I'm not going to talk in detail about them, but the new materials change even the types of trees we grow and the types of forest economies, which matters here in Australia a lot, that we actually generate our wood products from. We don't have to cut down old trees anymore. We can actually grow fairly young, fast-growth, rapidly renewable trees and glue them together to make these engineered products that allow us to build buildings that are very, very large. And the reason that's important, I believe, is that the model, if you can see the colors in this model, this represents as the UN FAO chart that shows the sort of level of forestation and deforestation that have happened over the last really 10 years. And what you could see in this is Brazil, which we often talk about, and Central Africa are bright red, showing the highest level of deforestation. But you can also see that Australia sits in that same part. And the thing, I hope color-wise you can see, that is most remarkable is the area with the greatest gain in forestry in the world right now is China. and it's not by accident. It's China currently has the largest forestry schools in the world. Our forestry schools in Western Canada used to be the biggest, and now China has the biggest. Most of our forestry schools are filled with Chinese students, and it's not by accident. There's an understanding that this is the future, and countries that join the future and get there fastest obviously have the greatest opportunity for economic gain. And that's why, as a Canadian, I'm all over this issue, but it's also why I'm here in Australia, to talk about why we need to invest in the R&D issues that Bjorn speaks about, and why it's important from a climate point of view, and why it's important ultimately to serve those 3 billion people. So I'm just going to show two more slides and I'm done. But basically what I want to show you is that currently my firm, and through a grant with the Western Canadian government, has actually designed wood buildings that are 30 stories tall. They're not built yet, but the engineering's done, the fire science is done, and it's entirely easy to do. It's staggeringly easy to do. It's just a matter of shifting our sort of mindset of what is possible, investing in the R&D that we're talking about, and accepting that these things won't happen tomorrow, but they only happen if we begin today. And that's really the end of my conversation. So let's go.
Well, you could never accuse our speakers of being wooden, could you? And thank you very much indeed, Bjorn and Michael. I'd like to now throw the evening over to questions. We have a roving microphone, given the size of the room, and in asking your questions, could I ask you to say whether you're addressing the question to either or both of our guests this evening, and state your name, and please keep your question as a question rather than a speech. Let's keep the question short and focused. Ma'am, in the front row, you please.
Question. I think it's probably mainly for Bjorn. I apologise if this is already answered on your website or something. I haven't looked at it recently. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the Zero Carbon Australia report that's come out recently.
Sorry, which report?
The Zero Carbon Australia. It's a plan by a group of engineers from Melbourne Uni that has, I think the idea is to actually have zero carbon emissions with salt stacks and solar energy and all kinds of things.
Sure. Unfortunately, I don't know that plan, but I can talk to, there's a number of plans where especially engineers have shown that we can do this, but that's probably absolutely true. I think we could probably have done that in 1950 if we wanted to, and the crucial point here is to recognize the economics of the argument. It's not a question of whether we can, of course we can, but the issue is, can we do so cheaply? That is, can we do so cheaper than fossil fuels? And the answer is simply no. Can we do it somewhat more expensively? The answer is probably yes. It depends a lot on just exactly how you implement it. And remember, politicians have a tendency to implement it really poorly. But even if you actually manage it very, very well, we're at least talking a cost 2-3% GDP, and quite possibly much more. Again, it also depends on exactly what is your definition of zero carbon, because many of these are essentially relying on the fact that many others are not being carbon neutral. That is, what do you do when the wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining? Well, you probably buy nuclear power from somewhere else, or you buy biomass, which of course isn't carbon neutral, but then you take it away from somebody else because we can't grow biomass for everyone to be carbon neutral. So there's a lot of tricks underneath, but the real point is to recognize, as long as it's fairly more costly, it's just not going to happen in anything but a sort of PR sense.
Yeah, that was kind of my thinking.
Yes, Zara Kimpton.
My name's Zara Kimpton. I'm a member of this institute. One of the things that you've just mentioned it in the last reply was about nuclear energy, because you've presented, your conclusion is that we can move ahead by making our energy cheaper than the existing fossil fuel. Well, one of the great things would be for Australia if we could have nuclear power and energy, but we have politicians who are refusing to acknowledge that this is even really debate this thing. How do we deal with that in Australia?
Shoot them. Yes. Yeah, I'm not going to I'm not going to approve of that. But fundamentally, let me answer your question in much the same vein, because I think really the point is, I did write up here nuclear. One of the reasons why I don't advocate nuclear up front is partly because it's very often used to just annoy the Greens. It's sort of the question that you ask Greens because they didn't like it before, but now they like it because it's not contributing to global warming. But I think the real point here is to recognize that nuclear is just not commercially viable right now. People tell you otherwise if you look, for instance, in the US, but that's only if you assume that you've basically written off all of your investments already. If you look at the estimates from even from the nuclear industry with their investments, the estimate is it's about twice as costly as the cheapest fossil fuels. And if you look at the Greens' assessment, it's about three times as costly. So the real point here is nuclear as we see it today is just not economically viable. Now, and I'd love to, whether we should engage in conversation like that, but let me just very briefly, if you look at the investment calculations that have been shown both from the U.S. Nuclear industry and many others, I'm not quite sure where you're sitting, it's very clear that they're just not cost competitive. They are only if you assume that you've already written off virtually all of your investment. Now, if you talk to, I've talked to Nathan Myhrvold, Bill Gates, they're investing heavily in fourth generation nuclear power, which is essentially saying that we can get that we can basically use the waste of nuclear, other nuclear power stations, and they will be cheaper than fossil fuels. I'm saying, great, that would be wonderful. I want to see that. That's one of the many innovations that we can have. Only we have to remember that was what we were told with the other three generations of nuclear power as well. So, I think this is going to be a race between a lot of different technologies, and we've got to ask ourselves, we shouldn't pick one. We should invest in research and development in all of those, and once one of them is cheaper, we should go for it.
Clearly, there's a lot of interest in the issue of nuclear power, and we had a debate on it a couple of years ago, so we may schedule another one for later this year at the Institute. Another question. Sir, you at the back. If you could ask you to state your name as well as your question.
Accident question for Bjorn. I'm in complete agreement with you. Your final solution, which you only developed, the very last part of the talk, seems to me bloody obvious. Right, R&D makes far more sense than spending billions of dollars to achieve very little. Question is, why is that not extremely attractive to all the world's governments and all these politicians who are rushing around doing other things? You didn't address that question. I'd like to put to you one answer. You haven't spelt out, you spent all your time making good points, but you didn't spend any time spelling out the institutional mechanisms, and most governments are oriented towards R&D for profit. They're looking for where can we get value-added return, and you can't get it from making energy cheaper because you're not going to be able to charge the royalties to a level where it becomes more expensive for India and China to use the new technology because they're paying the patent royalties on it than for them to continue using coal. Right now, it seems to me it's elementary common sense that third world will continue using coal till something's cheaper, but you won't get anywhere till you spell out institutional mechanisms, and including mechanisms that prevent Australia from wanting to do carbon capture research because we want to protect our coal industry, and Canada from wanting to build 30-storey high wooden buildings and doing research on.
Could I ask you to bring your question? Would you mind drawing your question to a conclusion? Thank you. Can we take that as a statement, or was there a question in there?
A question.
Thank you.
I think Bjorn
sure.
gets it.
I'd be happy to spell out very briefly the institutional framework. I think we have a very good framework already as funding research and development. We do that through what in the U.S. is known as the National Science Foundations, essentially peers granting very small sets of money to their to other researchers based on the innovative concepts of what they're proposing. I think the fundamental point is we should also take a page out of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation playbook. They essentially said, what are the 50 things we'd most like to see solved? I think we should say, you know, what are the 50 to 100 things we'd like to see achieved over the next 10 years? Set out X prizes to get them, and that would be an amazing way to energize both private researchers, government-funded researchers, and also just interested citizens. But the real point here, and I'd like to get back to you, because you say, how come that people are not doing this? I mean, come on, it's so obvious. Why aren't we doing it? And I think there's a much more important reason before that. That's why I don't really care all that much about setting out the institutional framework, because I think it comes down to us. The fundamental point here is to remember, why do politicians talk about global warming? Probably, you know, they also care about it, but because it gets them votes. You know, that's what drives politicians. And so let's be honest, do you guys remember Arnold Schwarzenegger in 2005? He was the king of global warming because he promised to bring California into the Kyoto Protocol, essentially in 2020, 10 years after he was out of the governorship. We all knew that. But we all applauded him because he was such a nice guy. He was promising to save the world. But essentially he was saying, I can't do the Schwarzenegger thing, right? But I solemnly pledge to have someone else do all the hard work for me in 10 years' time. And we believed him. And of course, Tony Blair, 1997, came into office, spent 10 years to tell the British government, the British people, how he was going to cut carbon emissions. He did no such thing. They increased 3%. They promised to cut them 15%. Didn't matter, because he said all the right things. Now, of course, Merkel, Obama, everybody else, probably also your leader, is saying, we're going to cut carbon emissions. We're going to cut by mid-century 50%, 80%. Come up with a number. Of course, not only are they no longer going to be in office, but they're probably no longer going to be here. So it's a very, very simple promise to make. I'm going to save the world. That sounds a lot better than saying I'm going to start increase investment in research and development up to 0.2% of GDP. That just sounds technical. You know, you want to show stuff. You want to show all the amazing solar panels, which is what the Germans do. They're the biggest consumer of solar panels in the world per capita, yet the total expense is going to be about $75 billion. The net effect will be to postpone global warming by the end of the century by about 7 hours. It'll do no good for a very substantial amount of money, but it makes everyone feel good in Germany. So we've got to stop applauding politicians making these nice-sounding promises that don't actually do any good. And of course, then we also have to remember, if you spend money efficiently, there's nobody who gets a lot of the pie. But if you spend it inefficiently, everybody gets a go at it. Yeah, I come from Denmark. We produce lots of windmills. Vestas, the biggest producer of windmills in the world, loves this conversation, and it's not hard to see why, because they get lots of subsidies from our government, from around the EU, but probably also from your government. So they love all this discussion. They want you to spend more money on subsidies. So we need to recognize that both politicians and many businesses want us to be inefficient. And so unless we stop applauding when the politicians are making these empty promises, and unless we stop applauding companies when they say, ooh, we're so green, give us more money, we're not really going to get started. So I think that's the way we need to go down. And once we've gotten that, then we can start talking about just exactly how we're going to make the investment, research, and development the most efficient one possible.
Dennis, in the front row.
My name's Des Moore. I'm not a scientist, but I've examined this climate change quite a bit. The question I wanted to ask you is, you've done some very good and clever statistical analysis. Would you not improve that analysis if you also looked at the statistical analysis of the science? And there are lots of things one could say, and I just quote one example. There is plenty of evidence to show that the increase in CO2 emissions does not produce increases in temperatures in many periods of the last century and a half. And if you go back into history, it's obvious that even more obvious that that's the case.
Yes, I think fundamentally you're absolutely right that there's not a one-to-one correlation between CO2 and temperature rise. It's important to say the UN Climate Panel only says it's somewhere between 50 and 100%. We can have that conversation, but in some ways I think it's a very futile conversation, because really what we're talking about is simply, it seems reasonable if you ask even the most skeptical scientists, more CO2 in the atmosphere means higher temperatures. The real issue is, does it mean just a tiny bit higher temperatures or a lot higher temperatures? In some way that reflects back to your argument of saying, are you very climate skeptical almost towards the denial state, or are you very alarmist, is it towards the end of the world stage? And I think the realistic outcome by any reasonable assumption is that we're going to get some temperature rise that is going to be significant, but it's not in any way going to damage, you know, be the end of the world or something that will mean we'll never be able to recover. What we need to do is, just like we do with many other policy problems, we say it's a problem, is there a smart way to fix it? But let's not fix it unless the solution is cheaper than the original ailment. And that's really what I try to go for. I think my time would probably be quite poorly spent trying to make other, you know, a lot of climate scientists who are pretty good at themselves try to go after their arguments. And I think if you look at what's happened, even if you look at the climate gate discoveries, all that was shown was that there's certainly a tendency, and I think we knew that already, there's a tendency to look for particular correlations. That's how science works in some ways, but you should have several different competing alternatives. You should also have much more space for skeptics. I think that has happened, and I think a lot of people are recognizing that it's more important to listen from skeptics. But my point is simply to try to get this conversation back to an economic point of view, namely to realize all of these, even the very skeptical scientists, agree that there is a problem. It's perhaps not very big, and that's, I think, where the skeptics diverge from the alarmist. But I think the fundamental point is about getting this straight, that is, that we don't spend more money than the problem is actually worth, and that we spend them in the most effective way.
My name is Alistair Urquhart. I'm interested in this wooden building up here. Is Vancouver the centre of this sort of work with big wooden buildings? I walk my dog every morning in an inner city trendy suburb, and there's a few 3 and 4 story little jobs going up. And what does the fire department say about it all?
Good question. So Vancouver is not the center. We're like many countries now, starting to compete to be the center for the conversation. But the good news is right here in Melbourne, there's a proposal to have a building, and I just talked to the architect before this, 10 stories, potentially 12 stories in wood, which if it gets built first before any of these other buildings, will be the tallest in the world of its type. So that may happen right here. So that's pretty exciting for Australia. Austria is looking at a potential 30-story. Theirs is combined wood and concrete. There's a proposal for 17 stories in Norway. It's happening all over the world. It's happening slowly, but you know, like the Eiffel Tower, it's one step at a time. And I think that's pretty exciting. From fire point of view, it's actually pretty simple. If you encapsulate the structure with drywall, it protects it from fire in much the same way as a concrete structure works. So it's actually quite easy when you move beyond the emotional discussion and into a technical scientific discussion. It's actually quite easy to solve. So we're kind of beyond that with our authorities now.
My name's Riza. My question is for Bjorn. When I was a student, I read a book by Michael Crichton called State Affair, and he heavily referenced your own work, so I went and I bought your book. And my question is, how has Michael Crichton's endorsement of your work affected your message, for better or for worse?
Well, I don't think, you know, I met Crichton a couple of times. I think fundamentally it was just a good way to get people's attention. I'm glad, you know, it got your attention. I think his book had about the same persuasiveness as The Day After Tomorrow. It's the kind of, you know, it's a fiction. Yeah, there's some threads of interesting points in there, but you shouldn't, you know, use that as an argument for how we're going to be spending hundreds of billions of dollars. Just like you shouldn't be, you know, watching The Day After Tomorrow. for those of you who don't realize it, it's a great sci-fi story, but about how all the world was going to freeze down because of global warming. We don't quite get that, but get great pictures and some stunning experiences. But fundamentally, the point is, don't make this about a fictional issue, but look into the analysis and let's talk about what actually works.
Excellent, thank you. We have quite a few questions and a few minutes to go, but there's a gentleman there in the aisle, halfway back up the room, if I may. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. My name's Victor Wayne. I'm a member of the AAA for Bjorn Lomborg. A lot of this presupposes, of course, that this is climate change is largely induced by humans. I'm wondering, are you able to quantitate in any fashion how much is? The point being that you've said that, for example, if everybody adhered to the Kyoto Protocol and reduced emissions by, let's say, 20%, the effect would be negligible anyway. I guess the extrapolation of that is, therefore, if you reduce it by 100%, the effect would be not all that much more anyway. So how much is this really all human-induced? I mean, versus, you know, we've had ice ages in the past and so on. I think that's a very important part of the argument as well before we go and do all of these things, isn't it?
It is, and as I said earlier, I simply take my starting point from the UN climate panel, which is saying somewhere between half and 100%, so 50 to 100% of the temperature change that we've seen since pre-industrial time is due to man-made global warming, which seems to indicate that we get a temperature sensitivity somewhere between 2 and 4 degrees centigrade. So that's what a doubling would give in the long term. That's reasonably what most people would say, perhaps slightly towards the high end. Most indications is that it's somewhere between 1.5 and 4.5. And again, if you ask the very skeptical people like Dick Linson, Pat Michaels, they would probably say 1.1, 1.2, so it would be somewhat less, but it still would be, you know, a significant temperature change. So we're talking about, would we see a temperature, I suggest that we'd see a temperature change of 2.6 degrees by the end of the century. If you had a much lower impact, it would be somewhat around 1 degree centigrade. Some of the really scary people like Jim Hansen and many others would say it could easily be 5 or even more. But the vast number of people, and that's again why I'm referencing the UN climate panel, would say it's probably somewhere in the band of interval that I also gave you, 1.6 to 3.8. So it gives you a good sense of proportion. You're absolutely right that if it gets much worse, it would indicate that we should probably do more. We should probably spend a little more on research and development. If it gets less, we should probably spend a little less. But it actually turns out to be fairly unresponsive to this because of two things. Partly because it's such an efficient investment that there's not many others that we can do in the industrialized world. And the second part is that even if we look at some of the other things that we could do, if it's gonna get a lot worse, they're not very effective. And that's really why, you know, this is the only option available. If you'll just allow me to speak very briefly more about that, one of the reasons why we don't spend money on research and development, you'd imagine we do. I mean, we talk a lot about green energy. Everybody talks about we should do something about green energy. But notice if you make promises you're going to cut carbon emissions in the next 5 or 10 years, you're not going to try to make solar panels efficient. You're simply going to go for technology that's already there or almost there and implement lots and lots of it, which of course is what we've done in Europe and many other places. There's one other thing you're going to do. You're going to cheat, which we've also done in Europe. You're going to basically buy ineffective carbon offset schemes like the ones that we've done in China, and or you're going to try to fudge the numbers by saying which date should you start from or update what you actually estimate that you emitted, for instance, in 1990, or you're going to start including land change use or all those kinds of things. If you look at what happens ever since the Kyoto Protocol was agreed in 1997, all the other meetings, at least up till 2007, 2008. So for 10 years, we're all about, you know, essentially diluting the agreement that you had made in Kyoto. So you end up spending lots of money on technology that's already there or lots of money on making essentially fudges. Instead, we need to start talking about how we're going to make long-term investments. And it's very simple. We do that in medical care. We don't expect medical companies, pharmaceutical, to be spending money on blue sky research that will only come to fruition in 20, 40 years. We do that through public money. That's why we spend money on blue sky research and Nobel Prizes. Then, of course, once we get close to marketability, pharmaceuticals take over, and they're much, much better at doing that. And we need to recognize that it's the same social benefit for investment in, for instance, green technology, that if I come up with a brilliant plan to reduce the cost of solar panels by a factor of two, it'd be brilliant for humankind. But of course, I won't make any money because it'll go from being 10 times as expensive as fossil fuels to only 5 times. I still can't sell it. And so the point is, the downstream benefit is socially great, but it's very, very hard to recoup the investment on the patents. That's why we need the public investment, and that's where it comes in as a good investment, almost no matter what, as long as you accept that there is some part of human-induced global warming.
We have time for one more brief question, if I may. The gentleman in the middle, halfway up the front. Thank you, sir. If you could keep the question... keep the question brief, that would be fabulous.
Ron Benson, a member of the Institute. Bjorn, humanity will always have a carbon footprint, but with the burgeoning numbers of humanity, one wonders whether the sheer numbers of humanity will overcome all the very good suggestions you've made. I understand China is the only country in the world that is addressing this problem, both with their one-child problem, but mainly their Maternal and Infantile Health Care Act, which effectively will stop less functionally valuable children from being born. Could you comment on that?
I'll comment on part of the question. You're absolutely right. The population is also a part of this issue. It's a much less of an issue in two senses that many people believe. One is we have this idea, and we certainly have that from the 70s onwards, that we're essentially just getting to be more and more people. But as the UN Population Division and many others have started revising their estimates, because we've seen essentially once you get rich, people don't want to have a lot of kids. Actually, they almost invariably in almost all developed countries want to have too few kids. We're, if anything, worried about the fact that we're probably going to max out around mid-century at around 9.3 billion people, and then it's probably going to decline. Now, there's still some chance it'll increase slightly, but certainly not by very much. So anything we could do would have a rather small change. If you look at what the demographers a little uncharitably call the average woman's output is in the developing world, it used to be about 6 kids per woman. And of course, it needs to get down to 2.1 to be in equilibrium. But it's already below 3 now in the developing world. And of course, it's much below 2.1 in most of the industrialized world. So if anything, we are getting there very, very quickly. Now, you mentioned the one-child policy in China. And yes, if we had an easy sort of dictatorship available for the entire world, maybe we could do something on that line. I'm not sure we would want to have all those other implications that would give us, but we don't. So it's simply not really available to us. We also know that there's very little you can do to change the number of kids that people plan. It actually turns out to be one of the most rationally decided ones. That is basically if you're poor and you have very little social infrastructure, if you're the woman is very poorly educated, you will get lots of kids because it makes sense for them to do so. And so all you can do if you distribute, for instance, condoms is that you just get better spacing of kids. They don't get them inconveniently right during a harvest or something like that. So the fundamental point is to recognize the smart way to deal with this is, as with many other problems, to get women educated and to get the countries rich, because then they'll be in our situation and say, we'd rather just have 1 or 2 kids. So the real point here is to recognize there's very little you can do. Even if you get everyone in the world down to 2.1 kids per woman, we would still see about 8.3 billion people by mid-century instead of 9.3. So the vast number of increases that we're likely to see over the next 40 years is really due to the fact that we're still a very young planet where a lot of people still haven't gotten their own kids. And I think that's going to be very hard to imagine that we could talk people into saying, don't have that. So the real point here again is to say you're right in principle, it's probably not as big of a problem as we'd imagine, and there's very little we can do about it. But fortunately, that doesn't matter all that much, because if we really can find a way to have cheap green energy, like nuclear, like many of the other technologies that we've talked about with solar, wind, geothermal, and many others, it won't matter, because then we can actually also support people in a carbon sense. But of course, it's crucial to recognize that we can also house them, and we certainly know that with with the estimates from the FAO, we can feed them till 2050. So we do actually have a good chance of being able to do all the great things that we need to do to, in order to be able to say we left a better world for our descendants.
Well, Bjorn, I want you on my pub trivia night team next time around, because your command of the facts is extraordinary. So, it's 7:30. We'll draw proceedings to a close. Thank you very much indeed for coming this evening. I'd like to specifically thank Rick Sinclair, who's the Chief Executive of Forestwood Products Australia, for making this event possible by bringing Bjorn and Michael to Australia. A more timely discussion on the topic couldn't be imagined in the context of what's happening in Australia at the moment with the announcement of a carbon tax by the Gillard government, and we'll see how that plays out. Michael and Bjorn, you'd be most welcome to visit the Institute again, should be in Australia at a future time. We'd be delighted to have you back. We thank you very much for coming this evening. I would like to just draw your attention to those of you that haven't perhaps been to an Institute event before, that our yellow flyer, which some of you have received, and more copies of which are available outside, canvasses our program in coming weeks. And we've had some great events already this year, and we have many more to come, but this one has been fabulous. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Good. Yeah. I'm just good.